20 jobs, who was on amphetamines, who'd had a paranoid schizophrenic break. He talked about Judy, his sister, and I got the flavor that somehow, even though his mother was described as a strong person, that somehow, within the family, women were put down. I asked him about himself. He described himself as a striving person, making the point that he would never have achieved what he had achieved or gotten where he had gotten if he had not been a striving person, that he was good at athletics. He made a point of never having cheated. Usually, when I ask that kind of question, I'll say, "Okay, those are some of your good points. Can you tell me some of your bad points?" He described himself as compulsive, and here was the first time that any feeling, or what he called affect, came out. He became sad, almost tearful, said that he was not accepting of his own family, said not as accepting as a good father should be. He volunteered that he saw that as strange in himself, because he was never annoyed by patients. He always could take all the crap that any patient could give him. He talked about what could have been if his family had not been killed, said he could have had a closer relationship with Colette. He could have had a better relationship with the children. He described his wife as being the best mother in the world, warm, understood the kids completely. He talked about knowing her since eighth grade and dating since eighth grade. They had broken off a couple of times. I did not ask why. I asked him more how he reacted to those breaking ups. He said that he would feel hurt and he would sulk, that she would cry and that that would hurt him. I obtained a sexual history. He said he'd had his first sexual encounter with the mother of one of his friends when he was 14 years old. He talked about Kimberly, who was a very feminine child. He talked about Christy as being a tiger. There was very little affect at this time. I was impressed with his coolness in giving me this information. He talked about his feelings about the army, the implication being that he had a lot of anger toward the army. He talked about his family's approach to Jay. He said his parents had been more casual toward Jay's accomplishments. He said that he, Jeff, had gotten more recognition than Jay. He felt bad about that. He felt that somehow that might be responsible for Jay's becoming a bum. I got into his use of alcohol. He talked about using it socially, judiciously, minimally, really. He said he used medication, and in fact, his wife had taken diet pills for some period of time in order to lose weight, and he himself had taken diet pills to lose weight when he was on the boxing team in college. He said that he was a fighter. His nose was broken 4 times while he was in high school, and that, essentially, was my first interview with him, which I deliberately kept relatively bland. I initiated the second interview by talking with him about his father. Apparently, there was a lot of feeling in the family about the father's death. He talked about his mother crying when he, Jeff, was around. He created the impression that he was sort of the person who carried the family through the father's death. He added at that time that Colette's father had committed suicide. I asked him if he could tell me any more about it, but he couldn't. I was not aware until he told me that Colette was pregnant at the time they got married. He made a point of the fact that they had intended to get married later anyway. He discussed entering service. All doctors, when they enter, go to Fort Sam Houston for a basic officer's indoctrination course, and while he was there, his thought was that he was going to end up in Vietnam, which was the expectation of most young doctors if they went into the service at that time. He spoke of a colonel coming down and giving a talk to the group about special forces. He was extremely impressed by the physical appearance of this man. He really was very impressed. There was a lot of feeling expressed about this man. It was almost as if the appearance and the presentation of the man, more than a judicious discussion of what would be involved in going into special forces, it was almost as if his impression of the man was more important. He volunteered further sexual history in terms of having an affair with an airline stewardess. I began to get a, you know, a question in my head in terms of whether, I didn't pull this out of him, whether he volunteered this to impress me or what, I don't know. They apparently, she spent a weekend with him in Texas, and this was apparently a second-time encounter that he had had. We talked more about his brother. He made the point that he was the only one in the family that could really handle his brother. He expressed that he didn't really understand his brother, and his family didn't understand his brother, and he talked about his brother's potential for violence. He was very upset that his mother had to see this violent behavior that the brother displayed. He expressed this with an affect of anger and shame. He said he was ashamed of his brother. Then we got to the night of the 16th and the morning of the 17th. He talked about having come home from work, having gone with the kids to feed Trooper, the pony he had bought. He talked at some length about having purchased the pony very secretively, that it was a big surprise to the family. He talked with some pride about having worked with the man whom he bought the horse from, or whose property he was going to keep the horse on, and how the two of them had... He would make up stories about where he was going, and he would go over, and they built the shed the horse would stay in. He made quite a big deal of it. I was aware that one of the points the prosecution was making had to do with some conflict between Captain MacDonald and his wife over the handling of the children, in terms of bedwetting, and in terms of the children climbing into bed with them. I had not raised it yet, but somehow at that point in the interview, it came up. His wife that night had discussed it with her psychology teacher. I have in the back of my mind, it's characteristic of doctors, it seems true in my family, that my wife never takes my advice. I can treat my kids' colds, but when it comes to medical opinions, you know, I'm low man on the totem pole. I'm not sure that isn't true in a lot of physicians' families, but I think there was a flavor of that there, and I began to probe and try to feel for areas of conflict between him and Colette, because again, the point had been made so strongly to me by the prosecutors that they saw this as a potential motive. I didn't get a degree of reaction like that from him. He said, in fact, that he wasn't upset that she had discussed it with the professor. I think I would have been, but he said he wasn't. The professor, he said, advised a firm hand, which is exactly what he had advised. He said, Colette could take less crying than I, and that's probably why Colette tolerated it more. That is, she couldn't tolerate putting Chris back in her own bed and making her stay there. He mentioned that his wife was 4.5 months pregnant. He also mentioned that he was reading a novel by Mickey Spillane called Kiss Me Deadly that night. He described his wife coming home from the course. He talked about having a friendly conversation with his wife. He was interested in what the professor had had to say and so forth. He later described how he went to bed, and Chris was in the bed on his side and had wet the bed. He picked her up and put her back into her room. There were periods here when he would become emotional, become tearful, but he recovered quickly. I recognized that he had been interrogated previously, and so I allowed him the lack of affect that I would have expected from a person describing these things about his family. I did not get much feeling from him at that time. It was matter of fact, but I gave him the benefit of the doubt because he had gone through this story so many times. As the interview progressed, I was becoming a little more probing. Christy was wet. Why didn't he change her? If she had wet the bed enough to make it so wet that he didn't want to sleep in it, I figure that would be a pretty wet diaper. He said that it wasn't. She was not very wet. She was asleep, and there was just a small amount of urine on her pants, and he didn't want to disturb her, didn't want to wake her, so he just put her to bed. I didn't buy that, but that was it. Then we talked about him falling asleep on the couch. He decided not to disturb Colette and make the bed or cover up the wet spot and go to sleep with Colette. He said this again in a very matter-of-fact way. Then we went through the arrival of the people in the house. He was awakened by screaming, and these people were around him. He related this again in a fairly matter-of-fact way. Later, he talked about running into Colette first, giving her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, feeling her pulses, running into the children's rooms, feeling for pulses, giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, finally knowing that they had been stabbed because when he would breathe in, the air would come out of the chest. He talked about coming back down the hall, talked about making the phone call, all of this again without much feeling, more of a clinical thing. Then he became angry. He said he was put in an ambulance. Some son of a bitch wanted to know his serial number. He was yelling. He was swearing. There was affect then, feelings expressed. I asked him what he was going to do when this was all over, and he said something fairly insightful in the sense, I, by now, which is after about a total of 4 hours of interviewing him, I had the impression that he was depressed. That what I was seeing as being clinical, as being matter of fact, was interpreted, by me anyway, as being controlled, very, I hope you understand what I mean by controlled, in terms of controlling his feelings, not allowing his feelings to well up. He substantiated that a bit in the sense of, he said he didn't know what was going to happen when this was all over. He said that what was keeping him going was that he was fighting, and that he was a fighter, and had been a fighter all his life. A fighter in the sense of defending himself. We talked about his mother having sold her house in order to help pay the legal fees. He said he didn't care about the money. He felt that he would recover, that he would go back to being a doctor. Then he got a very quizzical look on his face, almost wanting me to empathize with him, and he said, "You know, those bastards want to have a victory party when this is all over." He was talking mainly about his lawyers, and he said, "I don't want to have a victory party. I mean, this is a fight, but I don't feel there is any victory. I've lost my family, and I will be relieved, that's all." And that's the essence of my two interviews with him. As I have expressed before, I had a fairly strong impression that Dr. McDonald is a pretty controlled guy. He is capable of maintaining control, but he also has this device of going into some kind of tirade to avoid allowing emotion to become expressed. That is, the emotion may be sadness, but he turns it into anger about what they are doing to him. An impression that I began to get also was that he seemed extremely dependent on what other people thought of him. For all of us, how other people respond to us affects how we feel about ourselves, but that can go to an extreme, and I think it did for this man. He needs much, much more than the average person in terms of reassurance from other people that he's a good guy. I think that partly explains what we saw initially as a kind of naivete, openness, honesty. I'm talking about a matter of degree. I'm not trying to put a label on him or say, this is sick. I'm talking about it more as a way he operates. "All right," Victor Warheide said. "Now, could you put this all together and tell us what your psychological evaluation of Jeffrey McDonald is? What makes him tick?" "Well, I see this man, who was 26 at the time I examined him, as the sort of person who uses probably his primary mechanism of defense, his primary mechanism of handling stress, is denial. I think that explains, for example, his not putting a story together for himself until April 6th, or at least he says he didn't. He didn't think about it. It's sort of inconceivable to me that someone wouldn't be ruminating and thinking about it and trying to put it together. I think he's capable of just blocking it out. I think he used other mechanisms, action. I think I described earlier that he talked with some sense of grief about not relating as well with his family as he thought he ought to, and yet being able to relate to patients easily. I think to wear his doctor's coat was easier for him than to be a man. I think that's his orientation. I think that's probably why he is oriented to the kind of work that he is doing, emergency medicine, because he knows what to do. In talking to other people about him, I've used the word hysteric. I don't mean hysterical in the sense of histrionic, blowing your cool kind of thing. By hysterical, what I mean, as a professional, is a person who is extremely effective at using denial. If presented with 20 pieces of data, he is capable of seeing only 3 or 4 and drawing his conclusions from those. I see him as that kind of person. I was very struck by how his story seemed almost as if it were reconstructed. I don't like to use the word canned because that can be misinterpreted or distorted. But the story, even about the 17th, let alone his life history, was told in a way not so much rehearsed, but with very little feeling. That's what I mean by reconstructed. And that is part of the characteristic of the hysteric type of person. I'm not going to apply a label to him. I don't feel he is pathologically ill. But all of us have personality types. All of us have lifestyles. And I'm trying to describe his type. Part of it is impulsiveness. Example, buying the pony, I suppose. Example, responding to the colonel and the impression he made by joining the special forces. Also, tremendous dependence, again, on what other people think of him, and creating a good impression, the tremendous importance of creating a good impression, the tremendous importance of not letting other people see him break down and cry, as he put it, almost in a paranoid way, if you'll pardon my use of a clinical term, they get benefit out of my crying. I don't get any benefit out of it. And the importance of being an achiever, the importance of being a fighter. All right, Warheide said. I take it your conclusion was, as far as mental disease, he must be classified generally within the normal range? Yes, sir. Do you agree that he is a man with basic inner feelings of inadequacy, a possible lack of manliness, by his own definition of the term? I hope I've conveyed that. He needs to compensate. He needs to achieve. He needs to volunteer for jump training. He, in fact, had to lie. He had to lie in order to get into jump training, because on the physical exam, on the questionnaire, have you ever had back trouble, he checks no, because if he had had any history of lumbar disc disease, the result of his high school football injury, they would never have let him into the paratroopers. But he needed to do that. So yes, I see him as, well, having to work against a feeling of inadequacy. Having these feelings of inadequacy, and having to work so strenuously to overcome and compensate for them, maintaining the front, the facade that he had to maintain, do you think it's appropriate to say he had some underlying pre-psychotic tendencies? There, I have trouble. I'm just wondering if it's possible. I think it's possible. You've testified that under a situation of stress, he tends to lash out verbally at others. Yes, sir. Let me ask you this. In a situation of stress, let's say extreme stress in a family atmosphere where you have a combination of, say, fatigue, a possible recent quarrel, where he might be accused of a lack of competency, a lack of adequacy in the family situation, could he react in a violent way? In your presence, he lashed out verbally. I'm talking about lashing out physically. I think he could. Yes, sir. And could he lash out physically with sufficient violence to kill members of his own family? I believe he could. That's not to say he did. That doesn't say that at all. But you see, interestingly, there are a lot of clichés thrown around. He was brought to us, to me initially, as Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. He had been, you know, just peachy keen, achiever, super wonderful, all his life. He didn't come across to me as Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. He came across to me as having lots of holes. I can't label that as pathology, but if you're talking about the realm of possibility, in this man, yes, I think it does exist. We answered the standard questions in the sense that there was no evidence of mental disease, defect, or derangement, which was the primary question. But was there defect such that, even knowing the difference between right and wrong, he could not adhere to the right? We said no, but there may have been. We did the best we could. We certainly used every device we could to try to uncover illness if it was there. Did we miss the boat? We may have. Again, in terms of what you described, of a man who could suddenly lash out, if I were his psychiatrist, I would certainly play that in terms of defense as much as I could.
Temporary insanity?
Yes, sir. We had no evidence, but I said we did everything we could. We didn't actually do everything we could. There were periods of the night of the 16th, morning of the 17th, about which he was very vague and hazy, and I offered to arrange for an Amitol interview. It's frequently treated in newspapers as if it's truth serum, but it's really not that. I mean, it's not something that makes you tell the truth. What it does is, it's a procedure in which you use an anesthetic to a point where a person loses some degree of his conscious control of thought processes. And in a person who has a lack of memory, very frequently, it can help. Lack of memory, by the way, very frequently, is because of a need to not remember, rather than events just passing away. We offered to do an Amitol interview, and quite frankly, our purpose was twofold. As I said, he was a warm, engaging person. We were concerned about him. We did not want to precipitate more of a depression, but we felt that if it was underlying, then we might as well surface it and treat it, rather than have him live with his tragedy for the rest of his life. But we also felt that it would, if he were innocent, it would help him be more clear in his description of the people and of the events. He refused that. At this point, one of the grand jurors asked a question. If you were in Dr. McDonald's shoes, wouldn't you agree to take this test?
If I were in his shoes and I implicitly believed in my innocence?
That's right. I would certainly take the test. It could only help me. There is no way it could harm him? I mean, mentally? As I said, we might have precipitated a greater depression, but then we could treat it. That would have been the only risk. But yes, if I were in his shoes, and thank God I'm not, but if I were, and it were offered to me, I would take the test. You added one element in your previous answer, Victor Warheide said. If you were in his shoes, and you knew you were innocent, you wouldn't hesitate to take the test.
That's right.
But if you were in his shoes and you knew that you had done it, would you take the sodium amitol?
No, sir.
Jeffrey McDonald's brother was called to testify. He had arrived in Raleigh with shoulder-length hair and a buckskin bag fastened by a large wooden peg. 6 feet tall and weighing well over 200 pounds, he was the only witness among 75 equal in physical stature to Victor Warheide. Where do you live now, Mr. McDonald? Warheide asked.
Now?
Yes. Right here. Before you came here, where were you living?
Yesterday?
What's your address, your residence address? I don't honestly know what you mean by residence. I've always been curious to know what that means. Let me ask you this. When did you come here? What do you mean, come here? When did you come to Raleigh? You mean arrived in Raleigh? I arrived last evening at about 7 o'clock. And where did you come from when you came here?
I came here from the airport.
The airport in Raleigh?
Right.
How did you get to the airport in Raleigh? Eastern Airlines flight number 738. And where did you embark on that flight?
Philadelphia.
How did you get to the Philadelphia airport? In a limousine from the George Washington Motor Lodge near Fort Washington. And how did you get to the Fort Washington Motor Lodge?
In one of my automobiles.
And where did you start from when you went in one of your automobiles from wherever you were to?
From a house on 307 Aquitong Road in New Hope, Pennsylvania, on the planet Earth, where the subpoena was delivered to.
Do you keep your personal belongings in that house?
I keep my personal belongings in that bag, in that room, where we just came from.
But apart from those that you carry around,
Do you keep other personal belongings in that house?
Some.
And you sleep there from time to time?
Sometimes.
And you receive mail?
Only when it is imposed upon me.
The U.S. Postal Service, however, occasionally delivers mail there for you. It's addressed to you at that address. As I said before, only when it is imposed upon me.
Do you have a business or occupation of any sort?
I don't know what you mean by business or occupation.
Well, do you have any means of livelihood?
I don't know what you mean by that.
Do you have any means of self-support?
I don't know what you mean by that.
Do you have a source of income?
I don't know what you mean by that.
Do people ever pay you money for services performed?
Sometimes.
What services do you perform?
I occasionally would deliver a load of firewood.
Where do you operate this firewood delivery business?
Where I can. If the deal was right, I would take a load of firewood to Peking.
If people want to get in touch with you to order a load of firewood to be sent to Peking or any place else, where do they get in touch with you?
Word of mouth. In other words, and not to break your chops, but I'm unloading a load of wood someplace. Somebody might come along and say, "Hey, pal, where did you get that load of wood? I'd like to get one." In which case, I would make a deal with the guy, and I would deliver another load of wood.
Let's say they don't see you unloading a load of wood, but they know that you are a source of supply for a load of wood, and they want to get in touch with you.
I just told you how I operate, word of mouth.
Where do they come to find you?
Where they see me unloading the wood.
That's the only place they can contact you?
Yes, that's the only place they could contact me. That's the only place that I have been contacted.
I see.
Then you don't operate a store or shop, or let's say, an established business?
A shop? Meaning a permanent place of business in one location?
No.
Are you the brother of Jeffrey McDonald?
Yes.
And you're about a year older than he is?
About 19 months.
And you grew up together?
Yes, I guess so. Some would probably say that he matured a little more than I did.
Will you, at this time, describe the sort of family life that you and your brother lived as you were growing up?
With all due respect, I don't understand what that question has to do with anything about the situation that I thought I was brought here for.
Do you remember, Warheide said, when I spoke informally to you in another room prior to your coming in here, that your brother had requested that we call to testify a psychiatrist who had been retained by him? And do you recall that you were shown portions of the transcript in which your brother testified before this grand jury concerning the family situation, the interpersonal relationships within the family?
I recall that, and I recall that my response to that was that you could take all the psychiatrists and all the psychologists in the world, put them on an old troop transport, and you could tow that old warship into the middle of the ocean, and you could blow the fucking thing right out of the ocean, and tomorrow the world would go on like nothing happened, and nobody would miss nobody. That was my response to what we talked about in your office.
Yes, but we did talk about the family relationships, too, did we not?
Yes.
Will you please give the grand jury the benefit of your observations?
I don't understand what that has to do with the case.
Let me say this. I don't want to waste a lot of time.
You wasted 4.5 years.
Just listen to me.
I'm listening.
You're here to answer questions and not to ask questions. If necessary, we can take you before a judge. You can lock me up for 25 years. You can lock me up for 100 years. You can throw me out the window. You can take me down the hall and shoot me. But don't tell me that I'm not here to ask questions also, pal. If you're going to ask a question, I'll ask a question. You are here as a witness. I am here because I am commanded to be here by a piece of paper that was served to me in New Hope, Pennsylvania,
and that's the only reason I am here. Because if I didn't appear, some Gestapo would come at gunpoint and take me away and bring me here to force me to try and answer questions. And if I refused to answer the questions, my ass would be locked up, not yours. I understand that full well. And don't tell me that I am not going to ask a question if I am asked one. Now, if you want to ask me a question, before I put my ass on the line, I want to know why. I'm going to ask you the question once more, Warheide said. You can ask me the question 10 more times. Will you inform the grand jury of the interpersonal relationships in the McDonald family as you were growing up? I don't understand the question. Victor Warheide paused. He walked back to his desk. He sat down. He conferred with an assistant. He began to look through a sheaf of papers. Sighing deeply, he stood again with a new piece of paper in his hand. Do you recall a birthday party for your mother, which you planned and organized in June of 1969? Yes. Do you recall that Colette and Jeffrey McDonald were there? Yes. Do you recall that Penny Wells was there? No. Do you know Penny Wells? Yes. Was she a girl that you were dating at that time? At what time? During the time frame within which fell the birthday party for your mother in June 1969. That is possible. In all the years that I've known that gal, I've gone out with her possibly 10 or 12 times. At the time of that party, the main purpose in my mind was to satisfy a desire of pleasing my mother by giving her a 50th birthday party, since my father had been deceased for some time, and I felt that that was something to do. Now, if I made a date with Penny Wells, it was purely an afterthought type of a situation, so that I would have a companion for that particular day, or an escort, as it were. Well, do you remember whether or not your brother suggested that you bring Penny Wells to this party? As I just said to you, I don't even know if Penny Wells was there that day. And as I said in your office before, I could have balled her that night, and I still wouldn't remember if she was at that party. If she opened all the presents or handed out the presents to my mother at that party, I am not aware of that. Now, if I am not aware of all those things, there is no way I could truthfully say whether or not my brother asked me to ask Penny Wells to be at that party, with all due respect. I am not trying to break your chops. I'm trying to help you, but I am answering that question to the best of my ability. Do you recall that Colette was at the party? Yes. Do you have any recollection that Colette was offended because Penny Wells was there and was getting some special attention, let's say? I don't know if Penny Wells was at the party or not. And if I don't know if she was there or not, then I really don't know if there was any tension between Colette and Penny. Well, in your observation, was Colette in any way jealous of Penny Wells? I don't think there is a woman alive who could make Colette jealous in the sense of nastiness or vindictiveness. If she might have reason to believe, rightly or wrongly, that this other person was a threat to her marriage, how would she react? I'm not sure I understand the question. Well, if she thought that Jeff were attracted to another woman, perhaps to another woman to whom he had been particularly close in the past, and that this attraction on the part of Jeff constituted a threat to her marriage, in the sense that Jeff might leave her or have an affair with her or something of that sort. Well, you're saying a lot there. When you're talking about threatening a marriage, there's a lot of room to play with. In other words, certainly gals' marriages would be threatened if their husbands were having an affair. I dare say there are certain marriages that are threatened if the man isn't having an affair. Well, how do you size it up in this situation? You knew Colette, and you know Jeff. Yes, and if you're speaking about Jeff having an affair, I don't think that would be a threat in Colette's mind to the marriage. because I could very easily see Jeff having an affair and maybe 10 affairs, but no romance to the extent of feeling involved or a real true love sort of a situation. I take it Jeff was a man who was attracted to women, and women found him attractive. There's an old family joke that when we were growing up, the girls used to pay Jeff to dance with them in grammar school. 10 cents a dance. And I assume Jeff did have casual affairs with a number of girls from time to time. Well, that would be purely an assumption. I was never present at any of these alleged affairs. I don't have any films or tape recordings of those affairs. However, as far as my own opinion is concerned, and knowing Jeff quite well, I would say that he was capable of having many affairs. All right, tell us about Jeff, Warheide said. What sort of a guy is he? What makes him tick? He's a highly energetic, ambitious person. Unfortunately for him, I am his older brother, and he has had to live in my shadow, whether he wanted to or not. I am physically bigger than Jeff. We were brought up in a school system and a locality and by a set of parents who thought that football was good and sports were good and Boy Scouting and participating in certain community situations where we, as children and students, were brought into the public eye, so to speak. And just by the very fact that Jeff was a year behind me, he had to suffer the consequences of me getting the headlines in high school. I had no control over that. I had no control over the fact that when I was on the varsity, he was on the JV. My mother and father would come to the games on Friday night or Saturday and see me under the lights. And it wouldn't matter if I caught one pass and we lost by 100 points. I was still a hero in my parents' eyes. And not that they even went to his games, but even if they did go watch him play Monday, it was still a JV game. If Jeff scored 9 touchdowns, he was still a JV, and I was still a varsity. He was still my younger brother. I'm trying to give you some idea of what did shape his life, perhaps a little bit. I mean, it had to have an effect on him. Like, I made it a point never to bring a book home from school, no matter how much work I had, and I could always get by. He carried every book home from his locker every single night. Plus, he would go to the library and bring home an extra 10 for security. Then he'd read them all, and he'd be a straight-A student while I was getting by with a 70. Now, if you're asking me why he would do that, he was, in his own way, trying to be better than me, without saying anything to me or to my mother or father. Because he had to live in my shadow forever, and I think he might even have resented me a little for getting by without bringing home all the books. It's very difficult for me to converse with my brother and really make any sense. In other words, I really can't get into a conversation with him anymore and really have an understanding at a certain level. I think, philosophically speaking, my thoughts go off in a totally different direction from his own. My value system is altogether different from his. Now, why his value system developed the way it did, if it was just because of the position by nature that he was placed at, I don't know. I went into the Marine Corps. You know, like in the gung-ho sense, the rah-rah American-type situation, I think the only thing that could be better than that would be the Green Berets. And that's probably why, in my mind, he chose the Green Berets. Although if I said that to him, not only would it offend him, but he would deny it vehemently. But you tell me why he went in the Green Berets. You tell me why, if I do 100 sit-ups, he wants to do 101. If I drive 5,000 miles in 2 days, he wants to drive 6,000. But not to beat me. Well, you tell me why. As far as what motivates Jeff, I think as he was growing up, there was more of a sense of desperation on his part as to what the future held or what was going to happen, because he was always following in my footsteps, and they might not have been pleasant footsteps to follow. Like, I always had a job, and he could never get the same job. He'd have to take something a little bit less. When I was working as a stock clerk, he was delivering newspapers, because I had already delivered newspapers. Then when he got to be a stock clerk, I was working on the back of an asphalt truck, and when he was working on the back of an asphalt truck, I was driving the truck. He had to become a doctor because he knew that I wasn't a doctor. He was going to be a political scientist or whatever. He became a doctor. I don't know why, but I do know why, if you can understand what I'm saying. It's one of those unspoken things. I know why inside of me, and yet if I say it, that ruins everything, and then, because it would be denied. I think he still is. He had a tremendous sense of loss when my father died. I called him about 10 minutes after my father passed away, when he was living in Chicago, and I said, "Jeff, I have some bad news. Daddy died." And he instantly broke down on the telephone and cried. He really sensed a tremendous loss. I don't know if he ever really developed a... I think everybody needs a father of sorts. Somebody that they can talk to or lean on or cry on his shoulder once in a while. And I don't know who that person would be in my brother's case, after my father passed away. There was no one alive that would be an adequate substitute. If he was looking to me for guidance, he didn't see any, and so he went on his own. And, well, I think myself and my sister and my brother, we realized how much effort and how much of my own mother's and father's lives were literally given to us as children in order for us to have things they never had, the things they had to give up in order for us just to go to school. My father would get 2 jobs so my brother could go to college, and my sister went to college, and my mother had the job, things like that. We never talked about it, but then you begin to think, well now, we can almost see the end of the tunnel, and we'll be able to help them, meaning my mother and father, financially. Start to give them back the things they had to give up. But after you lose a parent, you can't repay those things. Now, we can't repay anybody. You can buy a bigger headstone. Speaking in terms of Jeff now, Warheide asked, would that leave him with a sense of guilt? I don't see what that has to do with the case. Guilt could enter into the picture in the sense of an unfulfilled desire or a disappointment. But if you were a reasonable person, and my brother was a truly reasonable person, you'd have to assume that he knows that he had no control over the fact that my father died. Warheide then asked Jay MacDonald about his brother's attitude toward Freddie and Mildred Kassab. First, Jay expressed his own opinion. "Mildred, I wouldn't waste my time telling you what I think about her. If she had 12 cents in her pocketbook, she would go out and get a $25 hairdo just to keep herself on the chopping block. She marries Freddie, and he treats her very well. Puts her in, you know, a $500 a month apartment that's not good enough for her. She wants $1,000, living in the best place in New York, you know. They should have been living in a $200 a month place. They were living way over their heads. But Jeff, you know, sort of liked that kind of life. I think he saw in the way they were living that that's the way he would like to live someday. From the way we grew up as kids, in a house that was constantly under construction, with very poor parents, to see Freddie and Mildred living in these luxury apartments, I am sure that was the way he wanted to live. But Jeff was too much of a real person to do it on credit. He wanted to pay as he goes. Still, he admired Freddie. Like the day they were married, we parked the cars in front of the apartment house and went upstairs to drop off some gifts, and we got back down, and there was no parking stickers slapped on the windshield that the doorman had put on the car. Well, Freddie ran downstairs, and I had never seen that done before. He chewed the guy out, berated him in front of everybody, made the guy get a bucket of water and a sponge, and wash these things off the car. That made Jeff laugh. He said, "Gee, I like the way he does things." But in other words, the guy didn't have a pot to piss in, and he was ordering people around, living in these big, fancy places. And I guess Jeff just figured, because of the way he was brought up, that's the way he would like to live. In other words, Jeff is the kind of a guy who would sit down with Freddie and say, "Freddie, you are a schmuck. You are really a phony son of a bitch, but I like you." I mean, that's really where it's at with Jeff. Well, Were the Kassabs supportive of Jeff and Colette? Are you kidding? Jeff was going to be a doctor. He could have been blind, deaf, and dumb, and a four-legged nanny goat, and Mildred would have been happy that Colette was marrying him, because he was going to be a doctor. She was just marrying off a daughter for the money angle. So if you're asking me, did they back Jeff and Colette? Yes, if that is what you call backing. Has there been any change in this relationship? Well, I would dare say that Jeff probably has lost respect for the man since Freddie has done a 180-degree turn. Not because he's against my brother, but because he was for him, and now he's against him. He was totally for him through the whole pretrial hearing. Now, you know, after the whole thing's over, and because somebody hasn't been brought to justice or to trial or whatever, he's willing to turn around and sacrifice somebody he'd really supported. Does Jeff talk to you about this? If I talk to him on the phone, like he'll say, "Freddie's making waves," meaning that the guy is, I mean, my brother lost a wife and two kids, and is at a loss for what to do. And he sort of gets to feeling that Freddie and Colette's mother think that they are the only people that lost somebody. And Colette's not even Freddie's own daughter. "Let's go to February 17th, Victor Warheide said. "When did you first hear about the fact that Jeff was in the hospital and Colette had been killed?" "I was at a friend's apartment in Queens, and I heard a radio broadcast that said there had been a murder in North Carolina, that a Captain McDonald had been wounded seriously, and that he was in a hospital, and that his wife and two children had been murdered." "Did you make any arrangements to go to North Carolina?" "No, I made arrangements to go back to the hospital." "Well, did you subsequently go to North Carolina?" "Yes." "Did you stay very long?" "I don't know how long we stayed, but we attended a ceremony at a Catholic shrine or one of the churches at Fort Bragg, and there were three white coffins on the podium where the honcho stands, and my brother was in front of me. I remember him walking in very, very slowly. He was in uniform, but he seemed to be like he could hardly walk. He shuffled like an old man would shuffle. My brother's the kind of guy that would, he's always breaking something, breaking bones or getting hurt or something. But the kind of guy that, you know, two salt tablets and another mile, you know, never give up. And he wouldn't have showed that he was hurting unless he had to. And he was hurting when he walked into that church. The whole thing didn't last too long. And when we walked back outside, there was nothing to say. He stood in front of me and he was shaking because he was quite weak. Plus he was emotionally drained. I knew that he was really hurting. I knew that he was hurting physically. And I knew that he was hurting emotionally, and I was at a loss for words. For the first time in my life, I didn't know what to say. I mean, I didn't even know how to console him, my brother. I didn't know what to say. He just stood in front of me, and there was nothing I could say. Then he was put into one of the army cars and taken back to the hospital. I'm not trying to pinpoint this as to time and place, Victor Warheide said. But sometime thereafter, did you talk to your brother about what happened on February 17th? Well, I knew there was no conversation about it until he was charged by the army. Then, like a little seed was planted in the back of my mind as to, you know, thinking that the army can never make a mistake, that if the army would charge my brother, then quite possibly he might be guilty. So I felt that in order to live with myself, I had to make up my mind whether or not my brother was a murderer. It took me 2 years to decide that he wasn't, only because I never, ever wanted to ask him point blank. I take it you did not point blank ask him? I never did, no. But you talked to him. Right. What did he say to you? He used to get so mad and upset that I had the audacity to ask him those kinds of questions, to the point where he would yell and scream at me. Not yell and scream, but I mean like, more or less, tell me to mind my own business, and how could I be so stupid as to ask a question like that? You said that ultimately you became satisfied in your own mind that Jeff did not, in fact, kill Colette, Kimberly, and Kristen. What was it that satisfied you? We were on a long-distance telephone conversation, I believe between Pennsylvania and California, and this has been after like months and months, if not years, of talking back and forth on the phone, and when we were together, and me asking in my own stupid way about what happened. And as stupid as this sounds, I don't remember what the question was, but the way my brother responded left no doubt in my mind that he was innocent. What was it he said? What was the clincher? The clincher was there was nothing he could say. He was crying. He broke down over the telephone. He cried and cried. In other words, it was the only other time that I ever heard him like that was when I called him and told him that Daddy died. Like, I could hear him break down on the phone, and there was silence for a long time. And that was what happened when I talked to him in California. What I was trying to do was to get him to break. I wanted him to yell at me and tell me to shut up or go fuck myself or get lost or something like that, which would cast a doubt in my mind. But when he broke down the way he did, as if, the government's against me, I lost my family, and now you, my own brother, are going to turn on me. That was like the straw that broke the camel's back. I realized once and for all, come hell or high water, that my brother was absolutely, totally innocent of all charges. The embarrassing thing is I don't even remember the question I asked him, but because of the nature of his response, the emotional level, that was something that could never possibly be faked. There is no way to fake something like that. Did Jeff ever tell you, after the Article 32 was over, that he was going to get revenge? He told me he'd been looking for these people in North Carolina. Did he tell you at any time that he had found one of the people? I vaguely recollect hearing that. Now, I don't know whether Jeff told me or whether that's just part of my knowledge of the case. Did he tell you what he had done when he found this person? No. Did he tell you that he had forced him to admit that he was one of the intruders, and after forcing this admission from him, that he killed him? No. Had he told you that, would you believe him? Well, depending on the circumstances. In other words, if he told me that in a joking manner, I would take that as a joke. Let's say he told you over the telephone. It's not a joking matter. No, it's not a joking matter. Say he told it to you over the telephone, or he wrote you a letter. He says that if you tell anybody about what I've said over the phone, I'll deny it. And he wrote you a couple more letters, and he says, I've gotten revenge as to one of them, and I'm still looking for the others. Would you believe it, knowing Jeff the way you do? Did that happen? He said it happened. Where's the body? You haven't answered my question. The stakes are getting high. Then he said he lied about it. Then he said he lied about it? He said it was all a lie. Wait. First of all, you're giving me what appears to be a hypothetical situation, although the situation in fact might be true. Then you're asking me to give an opinion about, I'm trying to probe into what sort of person Jeffrey McDonald is, that's all. Well, you'll have to give me a little more information, since my brother's involved and there's a lot of, in other words, that, why would he kill the person? If he said this to you, would you believe him? That's my question. If he said it, I'd have to believe him. And if he said afterwards, it's a lie, then you'd believe it was a lie? Yes, but I mean, if you want to get into something that heavy, I would certainly want more detail. Would you have a lingering doubt, if he said it was a lie, about having believed him the first time? I'm not sure I quite understand what you're saying. If you're asking me if my brother is capable of committing murder, then I say, if his family had been murdered, yes, he's capable of murdering somebody. If his family wasn't murdered, then I say he's not capable of murder. You had a lingering doubt for 2 years. Do you think he was capable of murdering his family? No. Why? He's too smart for that. It's not a matter of morals or ethics. It's just a matter of not getting himself in a bind like that. Right. He's smart enough to know that there's 100 alternatives. Is he smart enough to think he could beat it? My brother is not the kind of person that would put himself in the position of having to beat something. Mr. McDonald, Victor Warheide said, as you know, we have 3 dead people. As you know, there are possible suspects. These suspects include your brother, since he was the only survivor left in the house that morning, and the only information given came from him. His story may be believable, or it may not be believable. But is there anything that you can think of, that you can tell this grand jury at this time, that might throw some light on the matter? If I thought it would do any good, I would be prepared right now to sit here for the next 5 years and on to infinity and continue talking. I'd read the Bible backwards, forwards, and sideways and tear up phone books on my brother's behalf. He was cleared of all charges against him, and for him to be subjected to the same type of interrogation over and over again is beyond my comprehension. And it is beyond my sister's comprehension, my mother's comprehension, doctors that my brother is currently working with or has worked with in the past, people that he served with in the military, friends of the family, priests, lawyers. I could go on and on about what everybody seems to feel is the ridiculousness of the situation. In other words, how long can this go on? In other words, if he's found not guilty the second time, 4 years later, somebody decides that my brother is supposed to be subjected to the same sort of thing, and the whole process repeats itself again? Mr. McDonald, there hasn't been any trial of the ultimate issue in this case. To wit, who killed? You say there hasn't been any trial. In the sense of how you or whatever are the law agencies of any particular state or nation defines trial. In other words, a trial is, quote, such and such. But I firmly believe that my brother has been on trial, as have other members of our family, because our ways of life have been interfered with. Our psychological advantages or disadvantages, if you will, have been interfered with to a great degree. Our whole course of activity has been greatly interfered with. If that isn't a trial of sorts, I couldn't begin to tell you what I think a trial is. Mr. McDonald, you've been brought here to contribute any information that you can that will be helpful to the grand jury in resolving the matter, particularly any information that might be helpful or beneficial as far as the possible involvement of your brother is concerned. Do you have anything you wish to offer the grand jury? Freddie was on my brother's side, and when the whole thing was over and done with and no scapegoat had been found, Freddie turned against my brother and used his influence with somebody in the State Department or in politics in Washington somewhere, turned the whole matter around and put the onus on my brother. If you feel that there has been anything wrong said or done at any time during the course of this investigation by anyone, including Freddie Kassab, and you feel you have something that would be helpful to the grand jury and might be beneficial to your brother, now is the time to say it. What good would it do? Do you want to say it or do you not? It's up to you. What can I say? Whatever you have on your mind. This is absolutely incredible. You have nothing to say? I have a lot to say. Say it. What good will it do? My telling you my brother is innocent, that doesn't help me. It doesn't help him. You weren't there. You don't know what happened. I know that. But tell us whatever you want to tell us. My brother's getting a raw deal. Is that it? This whole thing is a sham, a farce. Is that it? This whole thing has reeked from the beginning. Is that it? I understand full well the amount of bullshit that is involved in this whole thing. Is that it? As far as you guys and all your investigators, I am on the 20th floor